Good morning. My name is Dr. Elliot Malamud. I'm the co-founder of Torah in Motion, which is an organization which is based in Toronto. And on behalf of my colleagues, Rabbi Jay and Mrs. Ilana Kelman, I want you to welcome you to our first symposium in Israel. Today we've chosen the topic of religious Zionism at the crossroads, and in the next 30 minutes I'm just going to give some brief thoughts on two contrasting visions of Zionism, beginning with the first chief rabbi of Mandate Palestine, which is Rabbi Avram Yitzchak Cook, and moving on to Professor Yeshaya Leibowitz. I've just brought you a few sources here. This is going to be really the hors d'oeuvres, not the main meal. And to try and open up some discussion about these issues. So the sources from Rav Cook are taken from Professor Shlomo Avineri, not to be confused with Rabbi Shlomo Aviner, his book, The Making of Modern Zionism. And we want to take a look at the sort of distinct viewpoint of Rav Cook. And when you think about, on Al Regel Achat, Rav Cook's sort of thoughts, they seem to be divided up into three distinct categories, one of them being a kind of metaphysical, almost mystical significance to the land of Israel, which has massive implications for both religion and politics. The second one, which is in some ways quite distinct, is the idea of almost a kind of divine game where secular praxis, that is the idea of secular Zionism building up the state, still has religious significance. In other words, God on some level uses the actions of secular Zionists, whether it's, building a bridge or building a house or making a garden, and that all of this actually has religious significance, right? Because his peers saw a complete split, right, between a religious worldview and a secular worldview. One is one is the other, the twains don't meet. Rav Cook was almost unique in the thought of saying that anything that anyone does to build up the land, even if they have no consciousness of doing it for a religious reason, is doing a mitzvah and is adding to the geula and so on. And the third strand of his thought is the idea that whatever happens here has universal cosmic significance. In other words, to put it in plain language, that building up the land of Israel is good for all of the citizens of the world, Jewish and non-Jewish. So these things, to me, are not self-evident, right? They're not necessarily available automatically to rational thought. So we have to think a little bit about why any of these propositions would be true. So again, his three propositions being, number one, that there is metaphysical significance to the land. Number two, that even secular activities in the land have a religious significance. And number three, that whatever happens here has positive implications for all the citizens of the earth. So let's just take a look briefly at some of these propositions in his thought, beginning on the left side here. Just the rhetoric here of the mystical. And let's just take a look, first of all, at Professor Avineri's comment about a third of the way down. We're on page 190 at the bottom. It should say Rabbi Cook, The Dialectics of Redemption at the top. According to Rabbi Cook, a Jewish person in the diaspora may fulfill all commandments of the law and see himself as a completely pious and devout Jew. But because he lives outside the land of Israel, there is a central ingredient lacking in his Jewishness. Living in exile not only distorts those commandments which are directly related to the land, agriculturally based mitzvot, for instance, but also the life of a Jew outside the land of Israel. Living in the diaspora means living a life of unholiness. Only living in the land of Israel can extricate a person from this predicament. So there's quite a binary dichotomy that's set up here between the spiritual life of somebody who lives in Israel and the spiritual life of somebody who lives chutz la'aretz, even if you're doing the exact same mitzvah, right? Let's take a look at some original source from Rav Cook near the bottom of the page. He writes, Jewish original creativity, whether in the realm of ideas or in the arena of daily life and action, is impossible except in Eretz Yisrael. A Jew cannot be as devoted and true to his own ideas, sentiments, and imagination in the diaspora as he can in Eretz Yisrael. revelations of the holy of whatever degree are relatively pure in Israel. Outside it, they are mixed with dross and much impurity. And he goes on in the same vein, right? So, again, this is taking the exact same set of commandments and saying that something about being here makes it different. Now, that's not as self-evident as we might think. Because if you take a rational approach to this, you might say, well, what's different about being here is that it's a national polity, that we're all supported by each other. People have, you know, there's more of a critical mass of Jews who are devoted to the same thing. But that's not actually what he's talking about. He's not talking about a kind of rational communal approach where you say we're building a Jewish state and therefore mitzvot here are more important. He's taking a mystical approach. He's saying something about being here, air, dirt, land, whatever it is such that doing the exact same mitzvah has different metaphysical implications. Now, one of the things that I want you to think about throughout the course of the day is, how is such an argument provable or refutable? Right? It stands there as a challenge. It's saying doing a mitzvah here has a place in heaven that doing a mitzvah elsewhere doesn't. This is not subject to any kind of verifiable, you know, practice. All right. So, moving along. Turn the page to the reverse side. The second strand of his thought, which is talking about the idea that somehow in God's plot, God's narrative of the world, even a secular building of the state unwittingly, right, unknowingly, has significance for these people. Now let's take a look at the bottom of the page. This is Professor Abinary's summation. Because it was a question in Reb Cook's time, why is somebody in the religious community so amenable to secular Zionism, which other rabbis clearly saw as antithetical to their project and even heretical. So I'm going to ask everybody, by the way, at this point, to turn off any cell phones they might have. The pioneers coming to Palestine, Rabbi Cook maintains, are highly hostile to Jewish religious tradition and are motivated, according to their own understanding, by secular ideological considerations, which are basically alien to the religious structures of Judaism. Let's understand what that means. What that means is that people in the 20th century coming on the secular Zionist project may not necessarily be doing this out of any sort of fidelity to mitzvot or fidelity to religious tradition, right? There's a huge segment historically that's reacting to nationalism, to the challenge of modernity, that is not talking about the fact that we're coming here because we think it's a holy place. So because of that, many of Rev Cook's peers saw this community as basically alien to their goals. But Professor Abinary writes, this subjective understanding of their own motives is only one side of the picture. In the divine cosmic order, where every detail is its own place and telos, the true meaning of a person's action may be unknown to himself. That's a remarkable idea. You're doing something and you don't even know what it is that you're doing. You have no idea how this fits in with a larger picture. You think that you're just building a bathroom somewhere in the middle of the country. You're not thinking about geula. You're not thinking about anything like that. But Rav Cook is arguing that you are part of the cosmic narrative. God in some way manipulating you. It's interesting, it's almost parallel to what we've seen in the last couple of parshiot, where Yosef is basically at the beginning of Vayigash, he's offering this sort of Cookian narrative where he says, you thought that you were doing something when you, you know, etc., kidnapped me, but actually this was all part of God's plan that I should come down into Egypt and I should save the East from famine. That's a very sort of Rav Cook way of thinking about how events unfold in the world. Because you're looking at things in a kind of temporal timeline. Well, I did this and this and this and this, and these were my motivations, and this is what I thought I was doing. But what Rav Cook is arguing is you're actually not in charge of what you're doing at all, because this is actually part of a kind of meta scheme that's taking place above you. Now, I want you to think of the implications both ways of this argument. On the one hand, it seems very amenable, almost conciliatory, to secularism, because he's saying, oh, I don't think that you're wasting your time. I don't think your actions here are rubbish just because you don't have a religious motivation, because it's all part of God's plot. But in the same way that the Yosef narrative can be seen, there's something a tad patronizing, condescending. Certainly if you speak to a secular Israeli, the notion that, well, you weren't really in charge of what you were doing, and actually the real significance of what you're doing is somebody else's plot. Nobody likes to feel that way, right? So I'm trying to point out that there's something complex about what seems to be a very nice, benevolent reaching out of the hand to a secular Israeli. I don't know that any of us would like to feel that our actions are actually trumped by something beyond and above us, even if saying that is supposed to make me feel better. So we have to think about both sides of the picture when we're thinking about Rav Kook. And let's look at the original source on the right side, right in the middle. It's in the indented paragraph, the second part, beginning with a small italicized type. What Jewish secular nationalists want, they do not themselves know. The spirit of Israel is so closely linked to the spirit of God that a Jewish nationalist, no matter how secularist his intention may be, is, despite himself, imbued with the divine spirit even against their own will. An individual can sever the tie that binds him to the source of life, but the house of Israel as a whole cannot. So, I mean, he's not hiding what he thinks. It's pretty plain. He's saying, you may think this is what you're doing, but actually there's this deep connection. And again, I would ask you sociologically, if you go out and speak to secular Israelis, whether they would buy into this ideology, think that this is correct in their own life, and so on. So just briefly, the third strand of Rav Kook's thought, the idea that there's a kind of universal redemption that comes from Jews coming to Israel, settling Israel, creating Jewish national life in Israel. On the next page, on the right side, so it should say page 195 at the bottom. Now, Professor Avineri points out correctly that this is connected to Rav Kook's not just interest, but deep knowledge of Kabbalah and Hasidut and the whole mystical trend. So Rav Kook views the salvation of the Jewish people not merely of particular importance to Jews, but of universal importance, tikkun olam. He basically thinks that when Jews come to Israel and create a national state here, this repairs the entire world. Let's take a look at the source that he uses here. In the middle of the page, again, the indented paragraph. All the civilizations of the world will be renewed by the renaissance of our spirit. All of them. Every single country on earth, every single culture is actually going to gain positive impact from Jews coming and settling Israel. Again, I'd ask the same set of questions, since this is being offered in a mystical way, whether their own self-perception, their own self-understanding of these cultures would agree with it. You know, if the person living in Borneo or Kenya or Kansas City feels that their life is enhanced, that their life is repaired by Jews in the land of Israel. There are, of course, many Americans who do feel that way. In fact, about 55 million of them, and they are evangelical Protestants who would roundly agree with Rav Kook's summation here. But anyway, all quarrels will be resolved, and our revival will cause all life to be luminous with the joy of fresh birth. All religions, right now he moves out of the socio-political sphere into the religious sphere. He says all religions will don new and precious raiment. They'll put on new clothes. Casting away whatever is soiled, abominable, and unclean, they will unite in imbibing of the dew of the holy lights that were made ready for all humankind at the beginning of time in the well of Israel, and so on. So there's a universal vision. Everybody's going to benefit. All religions will benefit. All cultures will benefit, and so on. Okay, so there is a question. I mean, we obviously don't have time for that. If you read in the secondary literature on Rav Kook, is he talking about Zman Hazeh? Is he talking about a messianic era, and so on? And this is all part of the discussion. Just a last thought while we're here on the next page. How did Rav Kook feel about the idea of actual sovereignty? Sovereignty is a messy business, right? Sovereignty is not a clean thing. When Jews are in exile, they're powerless for the most part and therefore cannot affect the events of state one way or the other. So they're not going to, quote, unquote, occupy anybody. They're not, quote, unquote, quote, invade anybody because they don't have the means to do so. But when you take power, you have to make political decisions. All countries do. That entails a certain amount of messiness. It's actually interesting to see what Ruf Cook has to say here. Page 196 at the bottom. He says that actually it could be that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed and the Jews exiled precisely so we would not have to face the messiness of these choices. Look at the indented paragraph about halfway down. External forces compelled us to leave the political arena of the world, right? So the Babylonians, the Romans, etc., forced us to lose sovereignty. But our withdrawal was also motivated by an internal will, as if to say that we were awaiting the advent of a happier time when government could be conducted without ruthlessness and barbarism. Note what he's saying here. It was good that we got kicked out, because to be in power means to have to make messy choices, perhaps to be ruthless, barbaric, right? If you read some of the writings of the left here in Israel, they use those exact adjectives when describing national life. I'm not saying rightly or wrongly. I'm saying that they're sort of mirroring his language. So hypothetically, he's saying, as he's writing this, I'm not sure it's such a good thing for Jews to be in power, because look at the kinds of things they have to do when they're in power. And he says, that is the day for which we hope. Now, this raises also a question that I want you to think about, whether this isn't contradictory or even oxymoronic. Can you have clean power? Can you have a situation where he's waiting for the day where Jews can get in power and not have to, you know, harm anybody, not have to make messy choices? That is the day for which we hope. Is that possible? Is it possible to combine this kind of mystical vision with real, you know, realpolitik? Of course, in order to bring it about, we must awaken all our potentialities and use all the means that the age may make available to us. Everything evolves by the will of the creator of the world. But the delay is a necessary one. It is good that we had to wait to come to this place and take over. And of course, he dies 13 years before sovereignty is achieved. The delay is a necessary one, for our soul was disgusted by the dreadful sins that go with political rule in evil times. The dreadful sins that go with political rule in evil times. Right. So, food for thought, Ruf Cook. Very briefly, let's move on to the polar opposite, which is Professor Leibovitz, right, who was born in, I believe, 1903. In Russia and came here and was a bit of a Renaissance man if you think about the fact that he was a professor of biochemistry and also, obviously wrote, thought about, lectured in Jewish philosophy. He's a controversial figure in Israel for a variety of reasons that we are not going to rehearse here, because I just want to focus on how his thought really stands in opposition to this sort of mystical vision that we've just rehearsed. So in an essay called The Religious Significance of the State of Israel, which was published 38 years ago, just about. He says two things that are striking. The first is in the first paragraph. He says, I wish to introduce myself at the outset as one who has not been disappointed at all, right, by the State of Israel. For me, the State of Israel has fulfilled all the hopes I had for it since my early youth. It seems to me that ever since I reached maturity and became a Zionist, Zionism meant for me the endeavor to liberate Jews from being ruled by the Gentiles. Period. End of statement. Right? That is Leibovitzian Zionism. All it means is we no longer have to be subject to somebody else's rule. No religious aspirations, none of that is meaningful. And to the extent that sovereignty has continued for, you know, coming on 65 years, it's a complete success for him. The State of Israel completely satisfies the demand for freedom from domination by others. And to the extent I'm able to recall my opinions of 50 years ago, I believe it never occurred to me to assign to the state, any state, including Israel, the function of realizing values, whether educational, cultural, or moral. Professor Leibovitz does not believe that a government, a country, a state should have the baggage heaped on it of trying to create meaning, religious meaning, cultural meaning, social meaning for individuals. A state is a technical, secular exercise in governance, and decisions should only be made that sort of the citizens can be defended. The way you would think about it in many secular Western countries, where in many cases there is a battle, as soon as you try and invest values in the public sphere. I'll speak of the Canadian experience for a minute. In Canada, there was an abortion law for a long time, and a man named Dr. Henry Morgenthaler, who performed many, 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 many abortions, he was actually a Holocaust survivor, and had his life threatened many times and so on, successfully sued in the Supreme Court of Canada to have the law struck down. The law was struck down, you know, years ago. There's no law that's replaced it. There's actually no official law of abortion in Canada. And if you look at the last series of political elections, every time anybody, even if there's like just a thin residue of somebody bringing the topic up, it's immediately slammed down in public discourse. No party will touch it. It's dangerous to even talk about the topic. Because the sort of consensus of Canada is we're not here to have the state define for us our values, right? That would be very, very Leibovitzian. Now, it is not the same as other countries. America has much more of this discourse going on, as do other places. But Leibovitz's vision would be exactly like that. I think he'd be, you know, thrilled with the Canadian political experiment. So you can imagine then that if the state is not supposed to be investing itself in religion and religious values, the first thing he would want is complete separation of religion and state. No religious parties, no decisions made on any kind of religious considerations, and so on, which would, as it did, place him on the left politically. But it's much more than that. It's the idea that he's invested philosophically in saying this piece of dirt has no metaphysical significance. Right? Theoretically, then, you have the opposite of Rabbi Cook. In other words, if I put on tefillin in Paraguay, or I put on tefillin at the Temple Mount, I'm doing the exact same thing. There is no metaphysical difference in what I'm doing. This is based on his theology and so on. We'll just take a look at one idea here, and then we're going to invite my learned colleagues up here. Take a look at the very last page of the booklet, 216, 217. He quotes a conversation about, 10 lines down. A conversation he had with David Ben-Gurion, who said to Leibovitz, quote, "I understand very well why you demand the separation of religion from the state. You want the Jewish religion to be reinstated as an independent factor with which the political authority will have to contend. I will never agree to the separation of state and religion. I want the state to hold religion under its control." So there's an irony where Ben-Gurion actually wants his friends close and his enemies closer, right? So that we know exactly where you are. Leibovitz writes, "The state has no religious value. No religious value. It's an empty vessel, right? No state ever had. Political achievements, conquests, victories are not religiously significant." So, of course, just to give one concrete example, and I'm going to close here, Six-Day War, the rhetoric around the Six-Day War, both in Israel and Chutz La'aretz, was filled with discussions of the providential nature of the Six-Day War, God on the side of the soldiers, and so on. In a word, this is heresy for Yishai Leibovitz. Complete heresy, has nothing to do with Judaism, is just people lumping on religious significance to what is essentially a military operation. The reason I point this out is simply to give you the wide contrast that you can find both in this country and elsewhere in terms of visions of Zionism, and trying to boil it down to just certain core questions, right? Does a country, a national entity, have any kind of religious significance beyond, of course, from a sort of Aristotelian point of view, the significance that you create? In other words, if people come to a place and do mitzvot together and create spiritual communities, so of course there's significance to that in terms of what they accomplish. But what the argument is here is whether there's anything sort of bigger going on when we do that kind of thing. Because if there's nothing bigger going on, then for Leibovitz, the only significance of being in Israel is those mitzvot that you can't do chutz la'aretz. That's it. Otherwise, the same mitzvot that you're doing here, you can do there. All right? And of course, for Rav Kook, we saw that there's massive cosmic significance to all sorts of things for the Gentiles, for the secular Jews, and for the religious community. Okay, I'm going to stop there. I'm happy to take a question or two, if there are any. Okay, very good. So we are going to invite these gentlemen up here with me. Just going to take about a 60-second break.